NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
It's 106 Central Time, 52 degrees in Urbana. This is the Afternoon Magazine. What follows is an interview from the archives. On February 5th of 2003, we talked with psychologist David Myers about intuition. That's coming up. Stay tuned. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. You have a hunch. Do you follow it or not? That inner voice can offer us a lot of insight, but it can also lead us into trouble. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, we're going to talk about intuition. I welcome your telephone calls, listeners, for psychologist David Myers, the author of Intuition, Its Powers and Perils. In his book, Myers looks at the ways of knowing. He explores the ways we use intuitive knowing. For example, investors anticipating the rise or fall of stock prices, human resource directors making hiring decisions, juries evaluating testimony, and coaches deciding who to put in and pull out of tough games. Listeners, I look forward to your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. David G. Myers is John Dirk Workman Professor of Psychology at Hope College. In addition to Intuition, Its Powers and Perils, he is the author of A Quiet World, Living with Hearing Loss, and The American Paradox, Spiritual Hunger in an Age of Plenty. All three books are published by Yale University Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Myers, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Celeste. Oh,
you're very welcome. You say right at the outset of this book, intuition is huge. Can you give us some idea of how huge intuition is?
Well, much more than we realize, thinking occurs off screen. Psychological science has been telling us for the last decade. So much of our life is lived on automatic. We're rather like those jumbo jets that fly mostly on automatic. And it's mostly adaptive as well. It feeds our expertise, our creativity, our love, our spirituality. But it does have its perils. And so what I try to do is explore both the remarkable powers of unconscious information processing that we experience as intuition, but also the troubles that can get us into.
How clearly have we been aware of the powers and the perils of intuition?
Well, of course, for a long time, psychologists have talked about the unconscious mind, but it's been only in the last, 10 or 15 years that we've come to appreciate how much of our thinking is in a different sort of unconscious than what Freud had in mind, not a seeding unconscious, but a cool unconscious that processes so much information about our life. And this automatic processing, which is the jargon term of the discipline today, really controls much of our thinking about ourselves and about others. It underlies our creativity. It helps us speak. I mean, most of us don't really have an idea how we, for example, say the word bad versus pad. I mean, we intuitively know how to do it. We have an awful hard time explaining it to other people.
Hmm. Well, we can talk and chew gum at the same time, most of the time. Is it accurate to say intuition is absolutely necessary for our survival, then?
Certainly. I mean, it's very adaptive, and many of the what we call heuristic or rules of thumb that guide our everyday thinking normally serve us very well. One example would be what's called the availability heuristic, which is a little basis for making a snap judgment about the frequency with which things happen. That is, things that are readily available in mind, that come quickly to mind, we use as an intuitive guide when judging how often those things happen. And usually that's a good guide, but sometimes that leads us astray. So, for example, horrific images of United Flight 175 slicing into the World Trade Center forms an indelible memory. It's readily available. And as a result, after 9/11, Americans were very afraid to fly, as many Americans were, indeed, but even before 9/11. And ironically, however, in this case, it's probably leading us astray in making judgments about what puts us at risk. For over the last half dozen years, the National Safety Council data tell us that we've been about 37 times safer mile per mile in commercial air flights than we have in automobiles. So when I fly to Washington, D.C. next week, I mean, I know, at least my head knows, that the most dangerous part of my journey is the drive to the Grand Rapids Airport. Mm. Once I'm on the plane, I can relax. But that's not how we experience life, and indeed this would be an example of how intuition is perilous, because it can lead us to fear the wrong things, as we so often do.
Yeah. Early on in the book, you say some things we know, but we don't know how we know them. When does our intuitive ability begin? Right from the get-go?
Yes, I think it begins from the get-go. Some kinds of knowledge, some predispositions to understand certain things and perceive the world in certain ways instantly are there from the get-go. But intuition also grows with experience and with expertise. So that, for example, a novice chess player may have to think very rationally and sequentially about how to make the next move. But an experienced chess master can look at a board and just intuitively know what the right response is. Likewise, a physician, a novice physician, will have to think through a series of questions in order to make a diagnosis, progressively eliminating different alternatives. But a master diagnostician can almost instantly and intuitively know what the problem is. I think one of my favorite examples of how intuition grows with expertise are what are called the chick sexers. Poultry farmers in the United States some years ago had to raise chicks till about 5 or 6 weeks in order to know which was the male and which was the female, because you couldn't tell them apart at birth. But they learned that there were experts in Japan that could do it, and so Americans apprenticed with them, and lo and behold, we now have a generation of people who can look at a chick and within about a second sex it with 99% accuracy, even though they can't tell you how they do it. They can't teach you how to do it. You have to kind of unconsciously learn what those very, very subtle cues are. But once you've acquired that expertise, then it's like intuitive knowledge. It's hard to articulate, but it's there.
Yeah. Well, it's like somebody who has a lot of experience with other animals, like let's say someone who works with horses or dogs. They're very aware of the cues of the animal and what's going on in the interaction between the human and the animal, but they might not be able to tell you exactly what they're doing.
Yes, but that's born of experience. I just am talking to you after my daily noontime game of basketball. And I play point guard with a group of people we play with. And, you know, it's just playing with these people for so many years, I kind of, without thinking, sometimes at least, know where to deliver the ball, anticipating the move that somebody's about to make. But that's something I couldn't do as a novice.
Mm. Well, since you mentioned basketball, let's talk about sports. It's March. And
Madness is upon us.
Yes, and Big Ten basketball tournament opened today. A couple weeks out, we'll have the NCAA Division I tournament. Let's talk about what we call the hot hand. Fact or fiction?
Turns out to be, in one sense, a fact, in another sense, a fiction. It is a fact that basketball players tend to be streaky shooters, just as baseball batters tend to be streaky. But the question is, are they more streaky than you would expect by chance? That is, if you know that somebody's a 50% shooter, do you gain any information by knowing that they've made or missed their previous three shots? If you believe the hot hand theory, as do most coaches, players, and fans, you'd answer yes. If a player's just hit three in a row, they've got the hot hand. They're in a zone to give them the ball. If they've missed the last three, they've got a cold hand. You might want to sit them on the bench, or they might want to pass up a shot that they would otherwise take. But in fact, analyses of men's and women's basketball players at the collegiate level and professional basketball players on a number of teams show that the previous outcomes give you no clue to the next outcome beyond knowing the player's overall shooting average. And this turns out to be true in baseball as well, with baseball hitting. If somebody's a 300 hitter, knowing what they've done the last time at bat, the last two times at bat, up to the last 20 times at bat, gives you no clue whatsoever. Sports fans, when I try to explain this to them, vociferously object. You just feel it. You've got the touch. You're in a zone. And all I can say is, yes, there are streaks. I'm not denying that there are streaks. But a weird thing about random data is that it's much streakier than people expect random data to be, such that you can find in the random digits of pi, for example, some curious streaks that are built in. Or just flip a coin 100 times, and you'll find all sorts of streaks of heads and tails there. So I guess maybe the practical moral is for a basketball player or a baseball or a softball player is if you've missed your last two or three, don't lose confidence in yourself. And if you've made your last three or four, don't let it go to your head and start shooting shots you otherwise wouldn't normally take.
Yeah. Well, if I was an athlete, I think I'd be much better off for thinking about these kinds of things, the information that you present in that chapter of the book. But I'm wondering about if I was a coach, what would I do with this information?
Well, I think it would help maybe restrain your benching a player who has missed two or three, and it might also affect how long you leave a player in before you rest a player. I know our coach occasionally gets criticized for taking a player out who's been in for 6 or 7 minutes and is really ready for a rest because that player has just made a couple shots. I think the player understands that that player is just as likely to make his next or her next shot if he or she has missed the last one or two shots. And by the way, all this takes nothing away from the remarkable powers of athletic intuition that are involved in making, say, an off-balance jump shot, for which the physics is really quite extraordinary to think about the, you know, adjusting for body motion, aerodynamic drag, and so forth in order to lift a shot over an opponent's defense, or what a softball player does after the ball is struck and she immediately leaves her point in order to intersect that ball as it meets the planet Earth, 50 feet away from her. And the mathematics of computing that parabolic arc are done intuitively.
Yeah. It's something that dancers call muscle memory.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. It's a kind of body memory.
Right. And you're using the entire, you're using memory and you're using body.
Yes.
And
yes.
I really like that term, muscle memory.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk with a listener who's waiting for us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello. I was wondering when people have to be careful with their intuition. For example, one might have an intuition, or it might actually be just a paranoid feeling, or one might think they have heard a voice from God, their prayers are answered, God told me to do X, Y, or Z, or they could be experiencing schizophrenia or some kind of psychological problem when they're hearing voices.
Right. And indeed, part of what we need to discern is when to trust our intuition, when to trust our hunches that Celeste was speaking about at the beginning of the hour, and when not to. And it turns out that our gut is very good at some things. We're very, very good at speedily reading emotions in others' faces, for example, though some of us are better than others. Some of us have better empathic accuracy, as it's called, than do others. And we're also, as I've just been mentioning, very good with intuition for things where we have developed expertise, where we have a lot of experience. But intuition is very bad at other things and really shouldn't be trusted, like guessing the fluctuations of stock market, which is something that many investment advisors, stock mutual fund managers and so forth feel they have a knack for, but all the data would cause us to doubt that. We're not very good at judging interviewees from an interview and predicting what kind of employees they will make. And as I mentioned, we're not very good at assessing risks. So I think it helps to know where human beings tend to have good intuition and where their intuition is not so good.
You wrote a book, something about spirituality, Celeste mentioned. So what would you say about a person who feels that they have a message from God?
Well, I would say, first of all, much of spirituality does relate to intuition. The last chapter of this book actually deals with claims of psychic intuition, which pretty much it seems not to exist. But it does conclude with an effort to try to attempt to separate out from that what a genuine spirituality or spiritual intelligence, as it's been called, might be. And all I can say is, you know, Moses said a long time ago in the Old Testament that one way to test the prophets is to put their predictions to the test. And to the extent that one's intuitions are empirically verifiable, then why not check them out and see if they work? At the same time, you know, to the extent that during times of quiet and meditation, people have a sense of the transcendent, you know, I mean, I don't want to dispute that. I don't want to question that. I experience that sometimes myself.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon is David G. Myers. He's a professor of psychology at Hope College. We're talking with him this afternoon about intuition. He's written a book on the topic, Intuition, Its Powers and Perils. He's also the author of A Quiet World, Living with Hearing Loss, and The American Paradox, Spiritual Hunger in an Age of Plenty, which the our caller alluded to just a moment ago. All three books published by Yale University Press. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. You know, we hear people talk about thinking with one's heart or being cool-headed and analytical. And in science fiction, as you point out, we have characters that exhibit these two ways of being. Star Trek's Data and Spielberg's creation in AI.
Mm-hmm.
Both are robots.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to people, to human beings, are we likely to be more one than the other?
Well, people do vary, and some people do seem especially skilled at reading others' thoughts and feelings and intentions. And this is a phenomenon called empathic accuracy. One researcher, William Ickes, down in Texas, has videotaped many interactions between two people. Sometimes they're strangers, sometimes they're friends. And then he has each conversation partner watch the tape and stop it at whatever points they had a specific thought or feeling that they can recall, and they record what it was. Then the tape is replayed again, and an observer, often the other conversation partner, is asked to guess what the first person was thinking or feeling at each of those moments. And it turns out that some people are reliably better at this mind reading, so to speak. And they are the people who are high in empathic accuracy. They're more intuitive, and others are more rational. The famed Myers-Briggs type inventory tries to pick up on this by assessing people's self-reported powers of intuition versus kind of thinking rationally.
And is one type of person better than the other at spotting someone who's lying?
Well, most people are not very good at spotting lies. There are a very few select people that have been much better than average at selecting lies, and they are CIA agents and Secret Service agents. It actually makes a wonderful class demonstration, Celeste. I have sometimes done this by taking, inviting 10 student volunteers and having them each draw a slip out of a hat, half of which say tell a lie and half of which say tell the truth. And then a few minutes later, each of them tells about some episode in their life Half of them are telling a lie and half are telling the truth. And the rest of the class is invited to guess who's telling a lie and who's telling the truth. There's five of each. And how confident are they? Time and again, when I've done this demonstration, people, the students as a whole, are hardly better than 50% accuracy. And yet, typically, they may feel 60 or 70 or 80% confident in their judgments. And this illustrates an interesting phenomenon, by the way, that's called the overconfidence phenomenon, which is the tendency for people to be more confident than correct when making all sorts of judgments. So, which is longer, we might ask your listeners, the Panama Canal or the Suez Canal? And how confident do you feel in your judgment of, in your guess from, I don't have a clue, it's 50% up to 100%? The answer, by the way, happens to be the Suez Canal. But on judgments like this, people who feel 75% sure of their answer typically are about 60% correct.
Let's talk with some other listeners. Next, we go to a caller who's waiting on line one in Urbana. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead.
Okay. I've got a question.
Sure.
Are we talking about the same thing from a cognitive point of view when you're talking about the sort of predictive behavior to predict, like a throw in rock, paper, scissors, and muscle memory for dancers? Are we talking, or is it two things which can be distinguished from a cognitive perspective?
Not quite sure. I have a handle on that question. You're asking whether muscle memory and the kind of judgments involved in predicting other people's actions as in a rock, paper, scissors task are the same?
Right. Well, you're talking about intuition in the sense that a basketball player exhibits intuition when they make a difficult shot.
Right.
And there's a lot of different processes that are going on that they're not consciously thinking of, and they somehow make this shot without really thinking how they're going to do it.
Yeah.
And so that's one. That seems to me to be distinguishable from what goes on intuitively when a person's playing, say, rock, paper, scissors, for lack of a better example, and you're trying to discern what a person's going to do next.
Yes, I see, which is a more cognitive judgment as opposed to the muscle memory that we were talking about
right.
earlier.
Right, and what I'm wondering about is, are there studies that distinguish how those two processes work within the body? Is one happening more within the muscles, or are they both happening within the same neural pathways
yes.
in the brain?
Yes. We refer to muscle memory, but surely what we're really talking about is, in both cases, are events in the brain that help the body respond adaptively.
Mm-hmm.
Might also help just to give a definition of intuition,
yeah.
which we've not yet done here. Webster's defines it as immediate apprehension or cognition, direct knowledge or cognition without evident rational thought or inference. So it's distinguished from rational thought, which is sequential and logical, in its immediacy. It's something we know how to do, and I'm saying Michael Jordan, when making an off-balance 17-foot jump shot, has a kind of gut knowledge of exactly how to do that. Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize last fall for his work in behavioral economics, and is, by the way, somebody that I credit at the beginning of this book has probably been the single greatest inspiration for this work, has said that intuitive thinking is perception-like, rapid, effortless, and he contrasts it with deliberate thinking, which he says is reasoning-like, critical, and analytic. So I think one way to distinguish the two, when I'm talking about intuition, I'm talking about knowledge that's instantly available to you as opposed to something that's reflective and analytic.
Okay. And what goes into making? Or I guess I don't understand what goes into intuition. What feeds into your besides experience? What I know, Carl Jung talks about a collective unconscious. I think you probably would shy away from those kind of ideas. But is there are there factors that beyond experience that are part of intuition?
I think experience is huge. Mm-hmm. And I would say also evolutionary psychologists these days are talking not about collective unconscious, but about certain shared predispositions we all have to respond adaptively. And these would include some of our perceptual mechanisms that seem to be innate rather than learned. Our ability to perceive depth instantly, for example, seems to be an innate ability. And also, by the way, I don't know if it would be of interest and certainly relevant to your question, some of the studies of people who've had brain damage that disrupts their ability to think and remember consciously. Take my father, for example, who's age 94 and a half, is one of these people who, because of a stroke, has lost his ability to form new declarable memories. If I call him after this program is over and then call him 20 minutes later, he won't remember that I just called him 20 minutes ago. And so in the same conversation, he may ask the same question six different times, get the same answer, and finally, when I've given the answer enough, I realize it's time to make the conversation draw to a close. Such people can nevertheless form implicit memories of experiences that they're having. So, for example, if somebody were to go in and when they meet him, prick his hand in a handshake with a thumbtack in their hand, it's very likely that the next day when they went back, he would not consciously remember them. He would lack an explicit memory for that person. But implicitly, he would not want to shake that person's hand. Mm-hmm. And we have lots of other fascinating demonstrations of how people exhibit implicit knowledge or memory of things that they cannot declare.
Mm-hmm. And so it almost seems like there's some sort of memory that's not, perhaps not in the brain, but or at least not in the part of the brain that we are understanding.
It's in the brain, but it's in a different part of the brain that is handling and storing the conscious explicit memory. Mm-hmm. Another fascinating set of patients are those who exhibit what's called blind sight. They lose their ability to perceive consciously certain parts of their visual field. And if you hold a stick in a vertical or horizontal position and ask them which position it's in, they say they don't have a clue. They can't see it. But if the researcher asks them to guess, they can guess with essentially 100% accuracy what they don't consciously know and can't consciously see. There is, says David Milner at the University of Durham in England, a sort of zombie within who is processing that information and that knows, even though the conscious mind doesn't know.
Mm-hmm. I'll ask one more question, and I'll hang up and let you talk with other people. But how well is it understood how the process works within the brain, how the intuitive process works within the brain.
Right. By the way, our studies of the famous split brain people certainly also are relevant to how the brain is processing information, so that when the right and left hemispheres are separated to relieve otherwise intractable epilepsy, and when information is transmitted only to the right hemisphere of the brain, the person may be able to, say, if flashed a spoon in the left visual field, which goes only to the right hemisphere of the brain, that person may be able to, with their left hand, which is controlled by the right hemisphere, pick a spoon out from among other objects, but not be able to verbalize what they saw, and not be able to even tell you what object they picked up. So clearly, the body knows, if you will, the right brain that can't consciously articulate what it knows and can display knowledge, which is not accessible to the left hemisphere, which controls language. Mm-hmm. So anyway, there's just lots of fascinating stories of people that demonstrate that there's a kind of realm of intuitive knowledge in the brain that is separate from And that's part of the powers of intuition.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. Next, we got a listener on line two, a caller in Urbana. Hi.
Yeah, I've got two questions. One, apparently Emerson, in a quote, he apparently argues that intuition is highest in those people who have the most susceptibility to, the future, a bad future, say. The actual quote is, woman as most susceptible are the best index of the coming hour. And my first question is, have you seen any studies that might substantiate that at all?
That people who have greater intuitive powers are better able to sense something bad on the horizon?
Well, that people that are people who have the most to lose from things going wrong, anticipate more and therefore have higher quote intuition unquote.
Okay, I haven't really seen any research on that. There is a lot of people who talk about gender and intuition and ask whether women have greater intuition than men, and without wanting to exaggerate that difference, there is a good bit of evidence pertaining to gender differences in ability to process nonverbal information. If you show people, for example, 5-second silent film of people discussing either an impending divorce or what they're going to have for dinner that night, women are, across a number of studies, better at gauging the emotion that's involved in that scene than are men. So there does seem to be a gender difference in the ability to decode nonverbal information. And the question, however, that's not controversial. The controversy that relates to your question is, why is that? Is that something that's naturally disposed? Or is that the greater social sensitivity of people who historically have been in subordinate positions and need to be more sensitive to the environment around them?
Exactly.
And that's what gets us back to your question. That would be the one literature I could think that's relevant.
Hmm. Well, and the other thing, another quote I have in listening to you, and I've kind of leafed through a couple, kind of contradicts what something you've said repeatedly now, and that is that intuition is born of experience. And that's a quote from Aldous Huxley, where he's actually arguing the reverse. And I don't know if you know the quote, but I'll give it to you unless you already know it. It's quote, experience is not a matter of having actually swum the Hellespont or danced with the dervishes or slept in a doss house. It is a matter of sensibility and intuition, of seeing and hearing significant things, of paying attention at the right moments, of understanding and coordinating. Experience is not what happens to a man, it is what a man does with what happens to him, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just curious if you think that actually is an argument against your proposition that intuition comes from experience.
Well, some people, as I mentioned, do seem to exhibit a greater ability to read situations and to read others' emotions and to accurately interpret their experience. But certainly, experience does matter greatly. Herbert Simon, who's another Nobel Prize winner in psychology, wanted for economics, because there is not a prize in psychology, is one of those who's emphasized how experience, freezes certain decision processes into automatic habit, and then they're experienced as intuition. The question is, a very relevant question right now, as a matter of fact, as the United States prepares to go to war, is to what extent can we trust various leaders' intuitions? George Bush, when talking about his about Iraq to Bob Woodward, said, I'm a gut player. I rely on my instincts. And a number of other people have said he really is. He's somebody who tends not to pay as much attention to analytical information as to what his own hunches and gut and heart are telling him. Well, if that's wise, so much the better. If, you know, I guess I'm one who's also very much aware of the perils of intuition, ways in which reliably human thinking can go wrong as we assess our own competence, as we predict the future, as we think about reality, and that's why I think intuition needs to be restrained.
But you don't see that perhaps what you're considering experience is actually born to a great extent, like maybe in Bush's case, to a great extent of his continual gut reactions to what has happened to him, and therefore, you know, it's kind of a vicious circle here.
Right. Well, and maybe, you know, maybe that is an area where he's developed accuracy, but there, you know, he hasn't had a lot of experience in exactly situations like this, having been governor of Texas and, participating in the ownership of a baseball team and so forth. So it's not quite like the CIA agents and Secret Service agents who've developed very good radar for reading other people, for example. But time will tell. History will judge his intuition, I think.
Yeah, harshly, I hope. Thank you.
Yeah, I fear it.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited. We've got about 8 minutes left in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Intuition, our topic this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. David G. Myers is our guest. He's professor of psychology at Hope College, and he is the author of Intuition, Its Powers and Perils. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, the telephone number is 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, back to this idea of trying to figure out who's lying, and there aren't very many of us who are good at it. In terms of our day-to-day lives, for example, if we're called to sit on a jury, what would you advise us? How would you advise us to try to look at various witnesses, look at the evidence, listen to testimony? How can we do that, knowing that our intuition might help, but yet it could be a very dangerous thing?
Yes. You know, we're pretty good at reading emotional messages that other people are sending out. When it comes to engaging the evidence that the attorneys are presenting to us, we probably need to think analytically and critically about that and to be mindful of the fact that it is very easy to be overconfident. Humans generally are overconfident in making judgments, and so that's partly why we have juries making decisions rather than individuals making decisions, because there's a kind of check and balances as various intuitions clash, and then people can air out their differences. And so I think the whole process of jury decision-making sort of recognizes that.
Hmm. Let's talk with another caller, a listener on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello.
Go ahead.
My understanding is that a person can read an article in a newspaper, and that's all they remember is the article that they read in the newspaper. But if they put them under hypnosis, their vision and their mind registers the whole page, and they can point out other things that they have also remembered, but they cannot remember it in a conscious state. We take in a lot more that registers indirectly, and I wonder if your knowledge of hypnotism can verify this? We take in a lot more visually than we actually think we see.
Oh, absolutely. We take in a lot more visually than we're aware. And this is strikingly evident in some really cool experiments that flash information too briefly for people to recognize that they've seen anything, and yet it has demonstrable effects on them. So, for example, if you flash a picture of a gentle kitten versus a wolf for too brief an interval for anybody to consciously recognize what they've seen, the brain can yet record some information from that, and it will affect how friendly and warmly they respond to the subsequent picture of a human being that they consciously see. So this subliminal, this unperceived information is having an effect. There's lots of other kinds of information that we take in without really conscious awareness of exactly what we've taken in. Where is the letter K on the keyboard of your typewriter or computer? You have a hard time saying, but your fingers know. Mm-hmm. You have to find it with your fingers. So clearly, we know a lot, and we take in a lot of information that we may not be consciously attending to. If you're at a party, there are other voices all around. You're not hearing any of those voices. You're attending to the person you're talking to. But let somebody out on the periphery say your name, and your radar catches that. Clearly, some part of your brain has been processing that information to which you're not consciously attending. So that's a very good point.
Also,
on the other hand, about hypnosis, there's, I think, a fair degree of skepticism about reports that people can do kind of supranormal things under hypnosis, recall information that they can't recall if they're not hypnotized or have kind of supranormal powers. And in fact, people who are asked to fake hypnosis to simulate and behave as they think they would if they're hypnotized behave pretty much as do people who are actually hypnotized. So I guess I would be from Missouri in regards to whether people under hypnosis would have extraordinary powers of remembering information that they've seen at a glance.
I want to thank the listener for her call this afternoon. Very interesting. And we're going to squeeze in one more caller this afternoon on the toll-free line in Dana, Indiana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Unfortunately, I joined the program late, and so your definition of intuition is something that I missed. But my read on my own use of the term is that sometimes, do you support a view that sometimes intuition can be a highly integrative function, that's to say, taking in data, and I don't want to make any due apologies to Mr. Bush, but it can be such that you can use a power of analysis in an integrative way, such that you pore over the data, and you can come to a conclusion about it that's highly integrative and a little bit different than we've been talking at least in the last 10 minutes.
Yes, and maybe that question is just a good way to wrap up this hour. I mean, intuition is huge. It does integrate a lot of information. More than we realize, our thinking occurs off-screen with the results occasionally displayed on-screen for our conscious mind. It's adaptive. It's a wonder. The spirit blows where it will, and I think that's an apt image of both intuition's mystery and its unbidden insights and inspirations. But intuition is also perilous, and what today's cognitive science is aiming to do is not to destroy, but to fortify our intuition, to sharpen our thinking. And thus, I think it's helpful to look at the powers and the perils of intuition in all sorts of practical realms, from sports to investing to clinical judgment to interviewer judgment to assessing risks. And those are some of the areas in which it's been fun for me to explore the powers and the perils of intuition.
I think that from a scientific standpoint, it's hard to set up studies that have credibility, because there are too many variables to focus on. But I appreciate your comment. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for the call. Did you want to add anything there, Professor Myers?
Well, certainly when we talk about assessing intuition in specific realms, we can do some very interesting scientific studies. How accurate are our perceptions of various kinds of risks when laid alongside the actual risks, known risks of various impressions of interviewees that predict their future job performance. Those are examples of questions that we can study quite objectively, and we have.
Well, there we will leave it. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. My gut told me it would be a fun hour.
I had the same hunch. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Celeste.
David G. Myers has been our guest here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's a professor of psychology at Hope College. He is the author of Intuition, Its Powers and Perils. The book is published by Yale University Press. It is 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. This is the Afternoon Magazine, that interview from February 5th of last year. David Myers, Intuition, Its Powers and Perils. I'm Celeste Quinn. Like, we have settlement prices now from the Chicago Board of Trade, and here with those numbers, as well as the highs and the lows on the day, Todd Gleason. Todd?
You bet, Celeste. Settlements in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Another wild day at the board. Interesting times. May you live them in them, and that is the case at the Chicago Board of Trade. And this is the way futures finish for the day at the board. In the bean pit, we'll get to these numbers completely in just a bit, off 30 cents in the nearbys. Interestingly, though, only about down 9 cents in the November. So we'll talk with that with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities at Newmarket, Indiana. When we talk with him at 2:06 this afternoon during the closing market report, let's begin this afternoon where we always do in the wheat pit. The March contract was down a penny and had a high today of 377, a low at 371. A settlement price for the March wheat at 374 today. Once again, it was a penny lower on the day. The May contract, 386.5, the high, the low at 379, settlement price at 381.75, down 3.25, and your harvest month, July, 389.5 in the wheat pit on the high, low at 383.5, a settlement price penny above that at 384.5, down 3 cents on the day. September futures for the wheat, 392, the high, the low there, 387, a settlement price at 388, down 2.75. December contract, 399, the high, the low at 394.5, a settlement price at 396.5 for the December wheat, down a penny and 3/4. Corn futures off anywhere between just a 0.25. That was all the way out in 2 years out in the December contract. But the nearbys and on out were down quite a bit lower than that. The March futures 298.5, the high, the low at 288.5. A settlement price there, 289.5, down 6.5 cents for the March corn. May futures $3.06.25. For the high, the low at 295, a settlement price at 295.75, down 7. And July futures 309.75 on the high, the low at 397.5, a settlement price near their bottom at 299.25, down 6.75. September futures 303, the high, the low at 293. And settlement price, 293.5, down 6 for the Septembers. December contract, 299.75, the high, the low at 291.5. That new crop December settled 292. It was 4.5 lower on the day. The March futures, $3 for the high, the low at 293. And a settlement price at 293.75, down 3.25. And July corn, 301 on the high, the low at 296. The settlement price right there on that low at 296, down 3.5 cents. December futures 2 years out, the 05 contract, 269.5 high, low at 267.5. December 05 settled 268, down 0.25 cents on the day. March oats now, 156.5 the high, the low at 152. A settlement price at 152, down a nickel. And the May futures, 164.75 the high, the low at 157. A settlement price at 158.25. They were down 5.75 from the soy complex. A correction day or a movement down based on some Chinese stopping out, well, actually not stopping out, but Chinese canceling potential soy and soy oil shipments, although I believe that was rumors. We'll take a closer look at that at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock this afternoon. It did have an impact at the board, 31 cents lower, 31.25 actually, in that nearby March contract, a 979.5 high, a low, 927, a settlement price at 931. Once again, they were down 31.25. May futures, 976 on the high, low at 926, a settlement price at 928.5, down 29. July beans at 963, the high, the low at 911, settled 914, down 30.5 cents. September contract, 844 the high, the low at 810, settlement price at 810, they were down 16.25, and the November's doing just a little better than that, 761 the high, the low at 739, the November, that's your new crop, 740 a settlement price there, down 9.75, so they're gaining on the nearby months, and that's probably something important to watch. January beans, 759 the high, the low at 740, settled 741, down 7 in the March contract, 754 the high, low at 738, settlement price 738.5, down 6.5 cents. March bean meal at 289.30 for the high, the low at 279, settle 280, down 390, and the May meal 291.50 on the high, low at 280.30, settle 281.30, down 480. The March oil 35.03, the high, the low at 33.30, a settlement price 33.35. They were down 122 for the day, and the May oil 35.05 on the high, the low at 32.90, a settlement price at 33.03. They were down 152. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Cattle were lower today. Lean hogs and bellies mostly higher. March feeder cattle 87.85, the high 87.10, the low 87.50, the settlement that down 55. April 87 even, the high 86.12.5, the low 86.17.5, the settlement that down 90. May 87.75, the high 86.80, the low 87.32.5, the settlement that down 65. August feeder cattle 89.40, the high 88.40, the low 88.90, the settlement that down 55. March live cattle 79.70, the high 79.35, the low 79.50, the settlement that down 20. April 78 even, the high, the low 77.27.5, the settlement 77.57.5, that down 22.5. June 73.90, the high 73.32.5, the low 73.57.5, the settlement that down 42.5. August live cattle 74.25, the high 73.65, the low 74 even, the settlement that down 30. April lean hogs, today's high 63.17.5, the low 62.55, the settlement 62.82.5, that up 52.5. May 62.50, the high 62.10, the low, the settlement 62.27.5, that up 15. June 68 even, the high 67.60, the low, the settlement 67.75, that up 27.5. July 63.90, the high 63.50, the low 63.60, the settlement that down 5. March pork bellies 98.80, the high 97.20, the low, the settlement 97.55, that up 25. May bellies, let's see, 125, the high today 98.60, the low, the settlement 98.70, that down 37.5. The Dow Jones Industrial Average currently down 89 points at 10,590. The NASDAQ off 15 points at 2043. The S&P 500 7 lower at 1149.
This is Les Schulte, WILL's Director of Corporate Support. If you own or manage an agribusiness, you can help in